Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and this is really fun for me. I've got filmmaker Klaus Hoke with me. Hey, Klaus.
Hi.
We are, believe it or not, basically neighbors here in Los Angeles, but we are talking on Zoom. So that's just my disclaimer. If anyone is unhappy with our audio quality, don't blame Klaus or me. Blame Zoom. So we're chatting on Zoom, and I'm happy to say I met Klaus at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019, where his music video Emergence was not just an official selection, but it took home the Grand Jury Prize for Best Music Video. It's, I believe we had a really great Q&A at the theater, and I told you just how much I love this work. I mean, it's a single, like you say, it's a single drone shot of two dancers. It's the whole thing is choreographed. The drone is as much a dancer as the dancers are, and Peter Manning Robinson is playing an amazing piano piece, and it's technically a music video for that piece, but it's, to me, it's just as much a dance film and an art film as a music video. And
it is all those things.
Yeah, it's all things at once. And so, and I'm excited to say that we got back in touch. I sent you an email and I told you about the Discover Indie Film podcast and TV series and stuff. And you have this wonderful attitude. You're like, yeah, put the film in. So
sure.
For people listening, when Discover Indie Film, this podcast gave birth to a TV series that's on Amazon Prime Video. So if people go to please go to Prime Video on a big TV. Some people watch movies on their phones, and that's tough for us film lovers to handle, the idea of someone watching a film on a 5-inch screen.
It is.
You can open the Prime Video app on a big TV, type in Discover Indie Film, and it'll autocomplete for you. And I believe Emergence will be in season 9, so that's something. And then also Emergence is already on my other fun side project of sorts. I don't know why I call it a side project. It's a real thing. It's called TVHI. So it's a smart TV app and smartphone app of great independent content. And it is called TV High because all the content is wonderful to watch no matter what. But if you happen to be able to use marijuana responsibly and it doesn't have a negative effect on your life, and I say it that way because I have friends who did have negative effects, but if there are no negative, if you can enjoy marijuana or anything else and it doesn't harm your life, well, then the content on TV High is even better. So the website is Watch TV High, TVHI. And what can I say? You know, when you watch the two film festivals I program, we get about 1,600 films a year between the two of them, and I watch them. And I have to say, just watching that many films every year, I just saw so many things that I thought would be great for a platform like TV High that last year we went for it and started it. So very happy to say that you can watch Emergence right now if you download the app TV High or go to watchtvhigh.com. But I think that's all the setup I need to do. Now I can just turn to Klaus and say, you know, I it was a pleasure to meet you. God, we met in November of 2019, so about 3 months before the world shut down.
Right. It's been time.
Right. And now it seems more recent to me, I think, because there was like a year and a half, almost 2 years, where very little happened in the real world. But
Especially we actually have been back.
And so Emergence is wonderful work, and I know it certainly wasn't the first thing you ever did. So, because I doubt someone would make a film that sophisticatedly their first time out. So I'm just curious, what's your personal history, your relationship to film and art and performance?
Well, I've been making films most of my life and also doing music and writing. And I ended up going to NYU. And I made some films there. And then I got out, and I was out trying to raise money to make films. And eventually I ended up here in LA, and I wrote a script called Flypaper, which ended up getting made, which was my first feature, my only feature. And it's sort of a real dark comedy in the vein of a lot of stuff I like. And And eventually I got very sick, and I had to do a large detour for many years where I was not being able to go out and do stuff, blah, blah, blah. And during that time, I just wrote a lot of stuff. And the composer on my film, he knew I was also into music, and we started collaborating together on creating this thing called the Refractor Piano. And out of that, I started shooting all these music videos with him and or having him stuff write that I wanted to do. And that's how Emergence came about. Peter wrote the music for me, and I had the idea and cast and did all that. And that's sort of like the process.
The process. So you actually sort of stepped naturally into making music video, but it was through your relationship with Peter.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Because I tried to do more, feature kind of stuff, occasional shorts. I used to do those a longer time ago, but then I hadn't in a while. And then Peter said, kept going, use me, do something with my music, let's do something. And, this Refractor Piano that we created can almost instantaneously do soundtracks if you want to do it, because it's really unique, And so that was sort of my coming back from this all this medical stuff, blah, blah, blah. So now we've made about, I guess, half a dozen together.
All right, I'm gonna make you back up a little further, because we kind of started at NYU. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Germany until I was about 7. My parents were divorced, and then I came over here, and I lived all over the States, different places. My stepfather was in the military, so I was in a bunch of different things. And then eventually... we had disagreements, and I had to leave the house. And then I was sort of on my own. I lived in Berkeley for a while, Minnesota, Florida, and then I ended up in New York.
As a kid, were you a lover of the arts? Were you interested in film and music?
Yeah, I was always doing film, photography, writing, and the music. And that started, usually elementary school, grade school, you got your little band, the bass player, writing stuff, short stories, writing for the school newspaper, editorials. And then it just all snowballed into this of always making films. And then I wanted to really learn the craft. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up going to NYU, because I really wanted to get involved with the actors there and the whole theater world, because I think that's the most fundamental, or one of them, in terms of filmmaking, is actors. They can make or break your film. And I really like working with them, other than the whole other cinematographic thing, I really love doing single takes, like Emergence. It's a single take, it's that whole thing of like Russian Ark, where they have a 2-hour film, one shot, 3 orchestra, 2,000 extras covering 300 years. You go, wow. So, all comes from that.
Yeah. And you have an appreciation. Obviously, you have a great appreciation for actors and performers, because like in a single take, especially if that's your focus, you're relying on them quite a bit.
Yes. And to be very exact, and it's also interesting because there's this thing where a lot of times when you do longer takes, it has to be very rehearsed, but you also want them to be spontaneous. You need some improvisation in there and working with that, Because there's some things that are just really heavily rehearsed, like that film Birdman, that was just really, really rehearsed. And there's other people who do longer takes, and it's just much more of your interacting with the actors and going with them and having, that's why I do a lot of my own camera work, because you need that interaction, and not everybody can fluidly interact with, you know, music or actors, you know. So
yeah, so you actually find, is that almost out of necessity that you end up running the camera because it cuts out a middleman of sorts?
Yes. Sometimes it's too hard to translate it, especially if it's reactionary, where you're interacting with people. And look, I'm sure there's people out there who can do all this also. And then also it becomes like a budget, you know, in time, you know, who, you know, and so, as a shorthand, I think it's easier for me. And then with the drone thing, it's different because three of the videos you ever see my site, are shot as single takes, you know, and there it's just the choreography with the drone pilot. And that became an issue because a lot of drone pilots just, you know, like the drone, they go over and they do this. Now, if they have to interact with actors, you know, and to get really in close, you know, and keep the drone 3 feet off the ground, a lot of them can't do it or they freak out. And it's nowadays, if I need to do a drone work, I actually need to audition them. You know, I've gone to parks where I put up trash cans and stuff and say, this is what the shot looks like. Can you do this? You know, da 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 da. And most can't, you know, and then you have to sort of simplify it and see what you can get away with. But it's also that interactive choreography, you know. So
yeah, because most the rudimentary way people use drones, and of course it's useful but gotten a little dull, is they just use it instead of a crane, right? It became the affordable crane for
exactly
for indie films,
and for like, me, it's a floating Steadicam.
Yeah, for you, it's the ultimate Steadicam. It's something that can work, do things in a space that a human can't.
Right.
Whereas most people are just like, you know, I want it to look expensive, and I can't afford a crane or a helicopter. So,
yeah. That's the traditional way of you can, and you can get some great shots like that, but they're just shots, you know. It's a tool. All these things are tools, and some people like to use them extremely. Do you know what I mean? And not just this way, you do it that way, you know. And it's just you have stuff in your head, and you figure out how to visualize it, you know.
Yeah, and so the visual ideas you have, like, did you work with Steadicams for a while before transitioning to drone, or is it?
No, I mean I've used Steadicams, not me operating them, but like on flypaper, I had a Steadicam, and he almost wanted to quit because I wanted to do everything almost with Steadicam, and they're not used to working all the time. It's nowadays it's a little bit more because that was a few years ago, you know, like most TV shows you see, everybody's got the Steadicam. But back then they were more prima donna-ish. You know, they would come in, I do a little Steadicam, and then I rest and you guys shoot, you know. And so I've always used or long handheld stuff. You know, I've become really personally as a, you know, cinematographer good at doing really steady handheld things, you know, and you know, that's the cheap steady cam. But it's really cool though, because if you can really do handheld really well, you can go really low, you can go really high, you can bend the angles and stuff you can't easily do with a steady cam, you know. And the
focus there, or the idea behind all that, is creating a point of view.
Yes. And when I started working with Peter and the music videos, the thing was also, this was live and nothing was edited. And there were no, you know, nothing, there's in the music, there's nothing that's pre-triggered or there's synths or anything. It's just organic acoustic stuff refracted live. And we wanted to do it in a single take to make sure people saw it and understood it as that, you know. And I would just then in a post, put in some effects that evolve throughout the piece to give it some otherworldly, surreal thing, but it's still one take, you know. So
for sure, and I do. So you said it's called a refractive piano, and that is something that you two worked to create together?
I actually called it a refractor piano because the idea is the same as with light. You know, you put it through a prism and it refracts all these things. What we're doing is taking acoustic music and refracting it in through our digital system and in the same way. So refractor piano seemed to be the best title for it, you know, and it's pretty unique. There's so much new stuff you can create with it, so much original stuff you can create with it, and it's pretty special.
Right. So I'm actually very curious about it. Like, is it a series of pedals or effects? Being processed?
Say you have a baby grand piano, right? You have a couple of mics, some transducers, and they run into our converters, and then through the software, some of it which we had commissioned, some of it that, you know, processes we do. And so there, for Peter, there's some pedals and there are some things to manipulate the whole thing, but it's purely the acoustic stuff through our system that comes out, and you hear the live piano and the refracted piano. And how it generates things onto itself is really amazing. And it took us 5 years to do it, from a big thing to bring it down to a system that's manageable, and also to get the processing power so that it actually works without breaking it down. So
it sounds fascinating. It reminds me, it reminds me of other artists who I really enjoy. All my life, I've been a fan of Robert Fripp's stuff, where mm-hmm. he would run a live guitar through a series of, whether it's, it used to be reel-to-reel tape that would allow mm-hmm. it to layer and loop and things. Yeah, so it's always wonderful when people experiment with the instrument itself.
Yes. And this one, because it's also a piano and Peter is a good composer, you can just create these vast soundscapes that, you know, I'm just dying to actually use it in a film that I do, the next film. You know what I mean? And it's just like, you know, because it's really remarkable. So.
And I assume it's something that as it developed, he learned how to play on it more effectively, or what? I assume the instrument itself, this refractor piano, inspired certain creativity to make the most of it.
Yes. Yes. It's something you interact with. You know, it's not something that it's just an effect that you do. You have to learn how to play it, you know? So.
Yeah. Which is, I guess that's another thing that just makes, it's another reason why someone like me responds to emergence, because there's just many levels of artistic expression in it. Whether, you know, because the piano itself is being used in a way that most people don't use piano, and then the drone is being used in a way that most people don't use drones,
and even the dance part. Originally, what I wanted was that it's shot in a warehouse, and I wanted the dancers to emerge from the steel beams. And then I realized how hard that was going to be. And the choreographer was saying that if they're in sort of some sort of a makeup that allows them to emerge from the beams, we're going to have really problems dancing for that long period of time. So what we did instead is I had them come out of the piano. So the music sort of gives birth to them out of the piano, because it's the whole idea is that they're inanimate. They become animate. They experience life and then they return, you know? And so this way it's even closer to the music, because they emerge from the piano. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Which they're an extension of the music itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Very cool. And is that, as you're writing this, or, you know, are you, I know it's a single shot, but are you sort of making a shot list of sorts that then the drone has to connect the dots between images, or?
Well, what happened is, yes, but I had sort of an outline of what I wanted. And then I worked with Emilio, the choreographer, Dosal, and then we had the choreography. And then we sort of put them together in terms of, you know, they emerge, this is part of the dance, and then, you know, that's related to the music, you know, where there are peaks and there's crescendos, there's valleys, you know, and then there's different areas. And then we figured out exactly where we were going to stage those. There's a scene in there where they open the doors and it's just this blinding light, you know. Originally, I had them going out with the drone and this whole other scene there. And I go, and then finally I realized it was going to be so hard to stage and, you know, expensive and all this other stuff. So we didn't do that, but that was part of the, you know, the choreography with the actors, because they definitely had 5 or 6 stages that they needed to hit in terms of their relationship to each other and their relationship to their environment. You know, and then we rehearsed it a number of times. We did about almost, I think about 16, almost 20 takes. And it was really hard on the dancers because that's a concrete floor. And you can see them doing a lot of stuff on the, you know, on the floor and stuff. So it was, it took that long to really get it smooth, because it starts up way up high, you know, goes to a close up, and then you start the whole thing. So,
yeah. And was this, did you have the warehouse space for a long enough period of time that you could rehearse in there and work it out?
A day.
One day.
Yeah.
So those 16 takes were all on the same day.
I had access to the warehouse to show Emilio what it was going to be. And then Emilio is one of the dancers, and the other dancer that he had, there was a show and they wouldn't release her. So two or three days before, he had to find another dancer and train her to do the actual dance. And they did that somewhere else. And then in the morning they came in, we rehearsed. And then after we rehearsed a few times, then we started rehearsing with the drone, you know, and then finally towards the early afternoon, late afternoon, which luckily the light was working for us in our favor, you know, then we started actually doing complete takes, you know, and the I'd say the last 2 or 3 were usable, you know, and I think I used either the last one or the second last one, but they were that concrete floor beats them up a little bit. So
I understand that. Yeah, boy, doing, I'm familiar with that. Dealers doing what happens in the human body when you do activities on concrete. Uh-huh. And I believe they're barefoot too, right? Or
no. They had on something.
Yeah, but dancer like shoes are
back,
yeah.
And they're spinning, you know, and doing all of that stuff. So not only are you having wear and tear on their body, you're having wear and tear on the costumes. We didn't have, like, you know, 3 or 4, you know, interchangeable costumes.
Well, yeah, and actually, and the makeup too, I imagine, was.
It's limited budget, you know.
Limited, yeah, for sure, for sure. But it sounds like, was everybody on board? Obviously, so you auditioned drone pilots till you found one that suited you. And yeah, jog and my memory, I didn't rewatch our Q&A from 2019, but, The drone, the camera angles could be controlled as well as the drone, right? So the drone moves, but then the camera on the drone can turn, right?
Yes, it's on a gimbal.
Yeah, it's on a gimbal. Yeah. Were you controlling the gimbal?
Who?
Is the drone pilot controlling both or just?
Yes. Yes. Because it's a smaller drone, a Mavic, and so it's intended for a single person operation, you know. We brought in somebody else to help out a little bit with a few little things, but yeah, it's because like when you see them from above, the thing that looks very geometric, you know, where they in that spin, it's like the drone is above them and the camera points straight down, you know? So yes, they're all movable and changeable.
I mean, I know I'm sure it was been mentioned to you before, and I know about budgets and that everything has to go to what appears on screen. But boy, if there was ever something I would have liked to see behind the scenes, because this kind of creative use of the, I mean, just to comprehend the drone pilot, to me, it feels like he's doing, it's as if you're asking one of your dancers to also hold a camera the whole time.
Well, speaking of that, when I started looking for drone pilots, I really couldn't find anybody. And then Emilio said he had a dancer friend who operates, a drone. And so that was one of the people I auditioned in the park. And he wasn't actually, he was like so-so, da-da-da. But he was a dancer, so he understood dance. And he, and his name is Brian, I forget what his last name is, Brian. He was the, the drone pilot. And he's also a dancer. So that really worked really well from that point of view, you know. So
interesting, right? So that makes perfect sense that someone who dances and pilots a drone would understand your goals better.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And you know, he was a little inexperienced, so we brought in a couple of other drone people just as collaborators or consultants, you know, in terms of the operation. But he managed to pull it off, and so it worked, you know.
Excellent. Yeah, and heck, a dancer who's also a drone pilot, I imagine it might have, this is just me bringing a negative attitude towards professionals, but someone who is a drone pilot all the time, 24/7, it's their only thing, might have fought what you were after, you know, whereas.
It really depends on the drone pilots. I've done, a few more that are single takes ones, and occasionally there'll be somebody where you totally understands it, has a feeling for the music, has a feeling for what's going on, and executes it, you know, flawlessly or appropriately, and it just works. And there are other people who are just much more mechanical, you know, where what is it that you want, you know, and you know that kind of stuff, where there is not that sort of aesthetic involved, and it becomes extremely frustrating. You know, that's why I need to audition people. I just cannot talk to a drone company and say, this is what I need, let's arrange for it, you know? And then the person arrives and, you know, maybe he's done a lot of real estate, or, you know, he likes to do the overhead thing, you know? You know, get in, you know, when you ask them to get 2 or 3 feet from an actor's face, they sometimes just don't know what to do with it because they haven't done it before, you know, and it scares them. And then if you have a emergence is 5 minutes, 20 seconds. If you have a 5 minute shot that has a lot of choreographic points, you know, they're not used to it. They don't like it. They don't want to handle it. They don't understand it. So
yeah, because I would imagine in general most drone shots are 5 to 10, maybe 15 seconds. Just like you said, just like with the Steadicam people who are like, yeah, just use me for the little Steadicam shot, and then I'll go put the rig back on the harness and just wait till you need me again. Yeah, the idea of them going through 5 minutes without a break is unusual, I guess, is the best word.
It is more usual now. Back earlier, in earlier times, it was more unusual. Now, especially with all the stuff they do in TV, if you ever watch it, you know, they're walking down the corridor and they walk to the office and they turn around, they come out. It's just, you know, now it's much more accepted, you know. But it's always a struggle when you're trying to introduce something new and people are just resistant a lot of times, you know?
Always, always.
Unless you have a lot of money and you just go, well, I want.
Yeah, money solves lots of problems. All of a sudden,
well, it gets people to experiment, you know? I mean, it's the same way with music. A lot of people don't want to experiment with music that much because they have to earn a living, and there's a certain type of music that, you know, people respond to and this stuff. So it's a fine line, you know. That's why there are a lot of broke artists, you know.
Oh yeah, you remind me of. I was once at a Q&A with Steven Soderbergh, and he had shot the film. He had been his own DP on that one. And someone said, "Which film? Do you do that?" And he said, "To be honest, I asked these cinematographers to break so many rules that sometimes they turn to me and go, people won't get the, people will think I'm screwing up."
Yes.
And I have to work for other people too. And so he actually said that I sometimes DP for myself just because it's so rule breaking that it's not fair to ask someone to do everything wrong for a show, because everyone will think they messed up and not realize I was demanding they mess up.
Right. I completely get that. That is that's why I do it. Not to compare myself to him, but it's like, you know, it's people have reputations, people have careers, and people, you know, are always also looking for their next job. And if you do this, really? No, that's what I want. Yeah, I get that. That's glad to hear it. What film was that?
I think it was. I'm gonna say the wrong one. It was.
It's okay.
What came after Traffic? Was it The Limey?
I'm not sure.
Remember,
the order,
but you know,
Limey,
it was
Out of Sight.
Yeah. And for him, actually, I believe it was about, like, you know, setting the aperture so that the light, like the windows are just blowing out the whole shot. And it looks, you know, any professional would look at that and go, the DP screwed up the aperture. But
right. Yeah.
He was demanding that it just blow everything out and the person just be this fuzzy silhouette in front of a blown out outdoor window. And
right.
Yeah, that was the specific shot. Someone praised that shot, and he said, well, let me tell you. Well, and so it sounds like, have you been doing stuff besides the collaborations with Peter?
Well, like I mentioned, I got really ill, a number of illnesses, and I wrote a lot of scripts. So I have a number, three or four that have been optioned or have gotten into other stages of development, but other than Flypaper, that's the only one that I've you know, gotten produced, that I wrote and direct. And so that was the other thing, and I was just took a sidetrack with Peter, and I'm trying to get back into the other stuff, and hopefully by the end of the summer, early fall, I will be able to do another low budget feature that. That's going to be low budget because it's going to be, you know, financed that way. but so there's about, like I said, there's eight scripts that are finished. Four of them had been optioned and or in development at certain things. They might eventually something happen with them or not. But right now, they have, you know, not. So, and they're all different, you know.
Yeah, you don't have.
I really don't do genre per se. You know, I they're just, you know, all over the place.
Right. So as a writer, it's whatever you're inspired to write, but you don't have any. You're not pigeonholed. You haven't pigeonholed yourself to a certain favorite sort of. Whether it's, I mean, I haven't gotten to see Flypaper, so I don't know if it's drama.
Flypaper is a dark comedic crime thing, sort of. It's sort of in the nature, not like, but like, you know, film, like pieces like Fargo, you know, Pulp Fiction, In Bruges, you know, along those lines. It's sort of that, and it's a fairly big ensemble piece. you know, and then some of the other stuff are, they're just all different, you know, a historical piece. There's a thing on violent straight edgers. There's a, you know, a thing on designer babies. There's a whole bunch of different ones, you know, and people generally like the scripts a lot. You know, they like the dialogue. I write pretty good dialogue. And so we'll just see.
I mean, it's so cool to hear you talk about dialogue, because I only know you for a piece that's wordless.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, look, when I was at NYU, especially, you know, and post that, you make a lot of shorts, and a lot of them, you know, I've always liked making films that are, you know, could tell the story visually, that you don't have to have the dialogue. So if you're going to have a dialogue, it should be really different dialogue. You know what I mean? Not the explanatory, the expository, you know, the stuff that you just want to, I don't want to hear it. I just don't want to, you know? So when somebody else talks in a different way, or a natural way, or an unnatural way, it's refreshing, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, you hit the nail on the head with, there's nothing. I sometimes spoil things, because when there is expository dialogue, I always just turn to whomever's with me and go, they really wanted us to know that.
Yeah, right.
They had the actor could have turned to the camera and said, I want you to know that is my long lost brother. So I'm going to call him brother three times in one sentence, even though that makes no sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like for me, when I see stuff like that, you're thinking about being on the set and actually having the actor say this or do this. And I don't want to be in a position where I do that to them. You know what I mean? Even if it's comedic or if it's dramatic, it doesn't matter. It can be interesting for the actor and the piece, and then the audience, you know, because you have that flexibility. Then that's why, you know, I think a lot of improv sometimes happens on sets because of that. You know, you just let them go. You know, like in Flypaper, there was an actor named John McGinley. You know him, John C. McGinley?
And who ended up on Scrubs and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, he's hysterical. And I had written some stuff, and then we started improvising, and he started working with it, and it just went. It was just, you know, that kind of a stuff where you allow for the flexibility, and you just allow for interesting stuff to happen. That brings it to life, you know?
It really does. Yeah. When you let an actor, make the words their own. You
just exactly. Get
a performance. And there, you don't have to be an insecure screenwriter who says, no, my words are precious. Don't change them. Yeah. It just makes
especially
sense.
Especially if you have them say stuff that's expository. Blah, 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 blah. Really? No. You know, just stop it. Just have them look at something, and that's even better, you know? So,
well, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, the expository thing, it's there's nothing I appreciate more than filmmakers who trust the audience and trust that we'll figure it out.
And the actors, a lot of times, you know, they're serious and they're good. And they're like, you know, people sometimes say, oh, they're difficult to work with or so, but most of them just want to have a good representation, you know, a good thing. And they're working for the best, you know? So.
For sure. And I always thought the dividing line was, if they want to change other people's dialogue, their own dialogue, they should just make the most of it and work with you and improve upon it or make it so it fits better in their mouth. But yeah, every once I've seen an actor wants to change other people's lines, and it's like, wait a minute.
Right. You're right.
Now you're playing screenwriter. Yeah. Don't boss that actor around.
And if you actually have stuff like that, that's stuff you do in rehearsals. That's stuff you do earlier. You know, if it's like a major thing where somebody has issues with stuff, you know, it's okay to voice it and talk about it, but don't do it on the day that you're shooting. You know what I mean? Then it becomes problematic, because then it affects everybody. Do it beforehand.
Absolutely. Yeah. There certainly is always time.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about this next thing. What is the next thing? It's the feature?
Well, the very next thing is another piece with Peter out in the desert called The Way Station. And that's actually another title for one of my other pieces. And that's, a sort of a surreal piece set in the desert with a couple of actors in a phone booth and, you know, stuff like that. And so we're going to do like a video a month, basically. Some of them complex, some of them just very simple. And then the next thing I'm still working on, because it's like I'm looking at my scripts and there's like one or two that I could possibly do for like a really low budget. But I'm not sure whether I really need, I should rewrite something new to do. So we'll see within the next 2 or 3 weeks, you know, before I start on that. And that'll be in the fall.
And the shooting something new every month, is the idea always musical first, or do you say I have a visual idea and then Peter pounds out some music to
suit
that?
It's like we've worked on these pieces for a while, and there's new pieces and there's older pieces, and so it's like let's do this piece because I think I can come up with a good idea for it, or I do have an idea for it, you know, and then other pieces might be that. If it's just solo piano, it might just be a performance piece and just very simpler. Like on April 7th, one is coming out called Pele Dreaming. And I wanted to do that. I like going to Hawaii. and this is about Pele, the goddess, Hawaiian goddess.
Yeah, the volcano god.
Yeah, volcano fire and the hula. And so it's a piano piece, and it's all about the lava there and the eruptions and her orchestrating that. So that's that kind of a piece. And that's the solo acoustic stuff. But it's pretty captivating.
Sounds very cool. Well, talk about a wonderful place to shoot outdoors in Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one we did before is called An Hour on Earth. Is about a guy who falls to earth, sort of, you know, thing. And that was shot out of, you know, Leo Carrillo.
Yeah.
Leo on the beach there. So we have like a really, that's another really surreal piece that it's very surreal. You have to see it in terms of what happens on the beach and the music and a drone, you know? So.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like a very cool collaboration. It's very fortunate that you and Peter found each other and have been able to expand on this creative relationship.
Yeah, I think so. And it kept me out of trouble for a while, but now I have to spread my wings a little farther, you know?
And, yeah, but it allowed you to stay productive and...
Yeah, and generate some ideas and let me, you know, at least I can direct and write and stuff and, you know, do that for a while. And I just need to, the other projects have been festering and some of them are really unique and good. And some of them require big budgets or bigger budgets, you know, and those are really frustrating because, you know, especially if they're like one's a period piece, there's no way you can do that for, you know, X dollars, you know. So there's so many of us out there trying to do the same thing, actually, you know. So I'm sure there's a lot of people out there just as frustrated in terms of that. But I just have this backlog of them. So,
I mean, it's I was just going to say, it's better that you have a backlog than if you're, like you said, you
right
creating yeah. fresh things.
Yeah.
And it must be. Yeah. I mean, you have already shared what it's like to write a screenplay and people option it. And I feel every time a writer tells me I've just got optioned, And I'm looking, and they're rubbing their hands together. They're saying, this film's going to get made. And I'm like, oh, I mean, getting optioned is wonderful. I'm so happy for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it's, what, a 1 in 300 get made? It's
yeah.
Still quite a long shot.
You never know
shot.
What the problems are. Like, I had one, which was really interesting, and they optioned, they wanted to option. You know, the thing is, with a lot of these, I'm attached as a director. So that's a whole nother thing, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, we're going to do this for this budget. Okay, we agree on it. Then they talk to their financing people. Then they talk about bringing in, you know, some name cast, you know. Then all of a sudden, if you're going to bring in the name cast or do this, the budget needs to be bigger. And then the financing people balk. And then they do this. And then they see what kind of return, you know, and all of a sudden it falls apart, you know, where it goes, oh, great. These people seem real, you know, we're going to get this made. It's really doable. And then all of a sudden it just slowly dissipates, you know, and it's just frustrating, especially if you've gotten really far, like you're casting, you have a casting director attached, you know, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And you have actors interested who have now, you know, read forward or accepted an offer, and you're like, wow, I have so-and-so. This is getting close. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's I guess it must be incredibly refreshing to be able to make these videos with Peter, because while that's going on, then you actually just get to start and finish projects and have something completed again.
Yes. And like this next feature, I think I'm in a position where I can self-finance it through my stuff and through with some other people. So I'm reasonably sure that I can make it. You know, there's not going to be no. It's actually, you know, I just want to be 100% sure in terms of the script and stuff, you know, but there won't be that element to it. Like, over these years, I've just sort of like trying to put myself in that position where I can actually do that. You know, if somebody else comes in later and wants to, you know, participate, that's fine, but it's not a requirement.
Right. Yeah. You're not, you won't be sitting back and saying, well, nothing's going to move forward until, like, in this case,
exactly.
It can move forward.
Right. Exactly. You know,
that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, obviously I am a biased person because I, as a festival programmer, and I see so many films, I love these films that are made exactly the way you just described. I know it's a lot for an artist to self-finance and whatnot, but then you truly get their vision or close to their vision. I mean, if their vision requires $10 million, then forget about it. But I think I personally appreciate seeing someone's personal vision versus watching something that's a bigger budget. And then, you know, you see all the compromises and you know, you can tell, sometimes you can even tell that, like, they're in a room and somebody said, well, you got, you know, you just see how things get compromised as they work through committee.
Right. It's true. But, you know, there are quite a few low budget indie films that get made that are pretty true to their visions, you know, however they've managed to put it together with self-financing or this kind of financing or whatever. I mean, when I see them, sometimes I go, yeah, this is, they do manage to pull it off, you know.
For sure. Sometimes I even say when a film is done, and I probably shouldn't name any of them, but I go, you know what? I didn't love it, but I love that it got made. Because at least it was
different.
Like, I don't know how these people managed to talk whatever production company into backing this loopy idea.
Right.
But they did. I don't, it's always impressive to me.
Well, what amazes me is when they do that, but it's like a $50 million movie. You go, really? Somebody was sitting in a room and they go, that's a good script. I really think you made. And you look at it and you go, this is truly awful, you know? So that's what blows my mind. As a business deal, even, you know.
Yeah, I know. Now you're dealing. Now we've stepped into the territory. Yeah, where we watch and go, wow. So whatever elements came together to get that film made, the quality of the film was not a factor. It was Yeah. It was certain actors and a certain location, maybe even a tax benefit somewhere for someone. And, you know, it turns out the whole thing was just happened because they got a tax benefit in North Carolina. And if they shot within 6 weeks, it's just, it's amazing.
You never know how that happens, you know?
Yeah.
They have a certain deal with, you know, a studio or something. And, you know, and it's amazing though. So
it is amazing that the number of people, well, here I'm talking shit about the industry again, but for the number of people who are in the industry actually don't even really love film. It's just another big, it's a money-making
business. Industry, it's an industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the industry side, you know, I have had lunches with people who are like, yeah, between us, I don't really like this stuff, but you know, I do what makes money. And I'm like, well, that's an intelligence. There's something going on there. But as someone who appreciates art,
that's why the indie world is so great, because in the real indie world, people generally do it because they love it. And they have a desire to do it and a need to do it and a want to do it. And it's for that, you know? And I see that so much and I respect that. And that's why I still like movies. And those few people who are in the upper echelons who still are allowed to do that, you know? Like Stanley Kubrick, he used to be allowed to do anything. And it shows.
There are the certain people, who... Yeah, and I think you mentioned the Coen brothers earlier. I always remember hearing the Coen brothers say something along the lines of, we can do what we want, because if the studio says no, we go, that's okay, say no. We're going to go do a $1.5 million movie then. We've got another idea that we can do for $1.5 million, and we know we can raise that. So feel free to say no. And then the studio starts saying yes to something like Hail Caesar, even though they know it's not going to make its money back.
I know. Yeah, it's a great position to be in, but
yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's, it is a small number of people in that position. And then Lord knows a lot of people just go, I really want to be in that position. It's like, well, yeah, a lot of us right. want to win the lottery.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that in TV now. You know, people used to not disdain TV, but it was, the lesser thing. And now it is on equal with features. And that whole world is now so combative and so competitive, actually, that it's ridiculous, in terms of if you want to try to pitch something to Amazon or, Netflix and stuff like that. It's almost impossible nowadays without, having that same sort of clout behind you in terms of studios and stuff. And it's, it used to be a lot easier, but not anymore.
Oh, yeah, I know. TV. Yeah, we are of the age that we can remember when TV was certainly just the minor league, right? It was.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah. And obviously it was even unheard of for a film actor to step onto a TV set was a big deal. It was shunned in a way. And then that finally went away. And now, you have huge, the latest trend is Harrison Ford is jumping into 30-minute sitcoms now.
Exactly. And so that makes all that more competitive and harder for more unusual indie projects to get made. And they're starting to phase those out, the quirky stuff, A lot of people complain about it. Isn't that a shame? Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a shame. There was five, 10 years ago, Netflix, I could go on Netflix and see dozens of indies I'd never heard of, and they dropped them all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, excellent. It's glad to hear how productive you've been and how all the work you're doing.
Trying.
Trying. Hey, it's better than not trying.
If you're a filmmaker or you're an artist or stuff, you have to be relentless. That's what you do every day to some degree or another. So it's actually, when it works, it's joyful. You know, sometimes it's horrible, but usually it's pretty joyful process.
For sure, for sure, and it shows. I think it shows. Yeah, the people who do it for the right reasons and do it for joy and for love of the art and the medium, I think it shows. It always shows.
Yeah. You see it in the films.
You absolutely do. And you can see when there's not passion, when it's just, you know, I mean, if someone's goal is to be the next Christopher Nolan, then, you know, their goal isn't to be them. They're the best artist they can be. It's to be somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why I
think. Yeah, their goal is to be Christopher Nolan. They should watch Following.
The very first one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nothing like the stuff that he's doing today.
Or exactly. You know.
Yeah, they should see. Yeah, that was self. Well, maybe it wasn't self-funded, but that was very low budget.
It was shot on 16 and transferred later. You know, it was almost no budget. Black and white, Streets of London, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
I will. I guess we discussed this in advance, so there's no website to send people to. But what we'll do is I'll have a clickable link to your Vimeo page where people can see most of your work. And of course, I'll repeat that they can also see your work on TV High.
They can get Flypaper on Amazon.
Oh yeah, go to Amazon. You know what? It's amusing, but people should go watch Flypaper on Amazon. I don't know why. And then give it 5 stars. God damn it.
It's got some outrageous stuff in it. You'll be pleasantly, hopefully entertained.
You know, the cast looks excellent. And you mentioned John McGinley. I know he's a great talent. I wish I saw more of him.
Yeah. Lucy Liu's in it. And, bunch of Craig Sheffer, Robert Loggia.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like you actually, and that was you said it was 99?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you were actually you or the casting people had an eye for talent, because those were a lot of people who went on to do bigger things.
Yeah, and the casting guy, Jeff Pizarro, still a friend. He's probably going to cast this next one, hopefully.
Excellent.
So these relationships last a long time, you know, like with Peter, with these people, you know, sometimes they just, you know, a lot of filmmakers have that, you know, we have relationships that, you know, like Clint Eastwood, you know, he's been working with the same crew for the last 50 years. Well, you know, they have a secondhand language to get things done. And it's a nice collaboration.
Yeah, and also I always add that the people who have long-term relationships like that, it shows they may, even if there's times when they are difficult to work with, it shows that they're a good collaborator and they don't leave a scorched earth behind them.
Yes.
Because those people are, actually the business is finally turning away from those people. Now it's actually a reputation as a screamer is no longer a benefit.
And it's no longer tolerated.
It's just not tolerated anymore. Yeah. There were times when it used to be seen as a feature. Now it's seen as a bug. Thank goodness.
Right. And there's no need for it.
There never was.
It's a great art form in a great environment. People can be just decent and pleasant, you know, just because there's so much other stuff you have to deal with. You know, it's just nice to be in an environment where the people are like, you like them and they're civil, you know. So
it is. It's you know, the world's getting better, I believe. We'll see.
I hope so.
I hope so. I happen to be lucky enough. It's a funny aside to get us out of here, but I was lucky enough last night. I got to attend a premiere of The Edge and Bono did a thing with David Letterman in Dublin, and it's going to be on Disney Plus. And Bono said, "The Edge lives in the future." And I always say to him, "How's the future?" And he says, "Better."
Nice. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very sweet thing to see between those two friends.
Uh-huh.
All right, Klaus. Well, I will go through my closing spiel so we can.
Thanks for having me on.
Really it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And I'll repeat for those who don't remember, thank you for listening to the Discover Indie Film podcast. If you want to learn more about this podcast or the TV series on Amazon Prime Video that was born out of it, just go to discoverindiefilm.com and it's at DIFWINS on social media. Klaus and I met at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival back in 2019. If you want to learn about that festival that we hold every November, go to ShermanOaksFF.com and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. There's a sister festival every June called Film Invasion Los Angeles. And if people want to look up that one, it's FilmInvasionLA.com and at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And that last thing I mentioned up at the beginning, TVHI. If you just go to watchTVHI.com, it's pretty cool. By the way, if people sign up on the website, it costs $4.20 a month, which is kind of fun. If people join it through an app store, it's on Roku and Amazon Prime. Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, Android TV. They don't let us do something cool on there like charging $4.20. It's got to be a 99-cent increment. So it's $4.99 on those services. $4.20 if you go to watchtvhigh.com. All right. Well, I've pimped out this stuff well enough. Thank you so much, Klaus.
My pleasure.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.